From WBUR in Boston, it's Weekly Warm-Up, a sampling of the cornucopia of stories and interviews featured on Only a Game, sports public radio style.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the Acura TL with Bluetooth phone connectivity. Learn more at Acura.com.
Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Karen Given's story about the Navy SEALs' Trident Challenge on last week's program provoked a number of spirited responses. How spirited for a euphemism. Anyway, Martha Raymond, who hears the program on Vermont Public Radio, wrote, "Shame on you, Bill Littlefield, for turning a fun program into a political commentary. You sent a reporter with a political agenda to the SEALs Fitness Challenge. She was more interested in how much money was being, quote, wasted on recruiting and in making comments about killing people. Stay off politics on Saturday mornings or we'll find something else to set the clock radio to at 7 a.m. Jenny Trashin, who hears the program on WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts, felt otherwise. Karen Given did a nice job of handling the "is this recruitment" aspect, she wrote, but the story lacked any mention of what the recruitment is for, as the sporting event itself probably did. The reality is that these kids are athletes one day and trained killers the next. Of those who see warfare, the ones that come home alive come home with their nightmares and a government that won't pay for their health care. From Providence, Rhode Island, L.J. Sammons wrote, "Charlie Pierce's claim that the dogfighting problem to which Michael Vick has been accused of contributing is best seen as part of a larger gambling problem underlying sports ranks as one of the most ill-considered comments to grace his typically bombastic portion of your show. The primary issue is not gambling, but rather the grotesque and inhumane treatment of the animals." WBUR listener Scott Shrine was irked by my conversation with Jeff Schultz of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution about Michael Vick. "Mr. Schultz suggests that virtually everyone indicted in federal court is guilty," wrote Mr. Shrine. "He might consider conferring with NBC and Tom Brokaw before making such a bold statement. An indictment means little and is at least a long way from conviction." Ed Lubin of Syracuse, New York, is upset about the lack of respect and coverage Only a Game has given professional cyclists. "The positive tests do not mean these riders are phonies," he wrote. "They train, race, and suffer. It may be that the results of the races are tainted, but that doesn't take away from the beauty of bike racing at that level." As Monty Python might say, well, a little. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Our address is Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can reach us through our website, onlyagame.org, or email us at onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. The Chicago Cubs haven't been to the playoffs since 2003, haven't won a pennant since 1945, and haven't won a World Series in 99 years. But after a weak start to their 2007 season, the Cubs are winning again, and fans think a series of weird events in June has inspired the team in their postseason push. From Chicago, Yolanda Perdomo has the story.
On the corner of Clark and Addison, throngs of fans, mostly wearing Cubby blue, head into the ballpark for a summertime game. Several of them stop to get their picture taken under the landmark red and white Wrigley Field marquee.
I don't know how to erase them, man. She's excited. This is her first game.
Matt Scalaris is taking a picture of his girlfriend and taking her to her first ever Cubs game. Scalaris says that as a lifelong Cubs fan, he hopes for the best, sees the worst, but sticks with the team regardless. He's happy to see them revved up for the first time in a long time.
It's Lou. As soon as he got kicked out of that game, he lit a fire under all of their butts. And then they started hitting the ball and they started playing like a ball club.
Scalaris is referring to the June 2nd game, during which Cubs manager Lou Piniella was ejected for arguing with an umpire. He later got a 4-game suspension. The day before, pitcher Carlos Zambrano and catcher Michael Barrett took part in the much-heralded slugout in the dugout, which was seen by millions, including Baseball Digest managing editor Bob Kenster.
I think the Cubs were just going through a transition with a new manager, and, you know, you got a big player like who they had just signed in Soriano, and big expectations from the beginning of the season were expected of the Cubs, and when they started to lose, I think they got a little frustrated. They were just still feeling each other. They weren't gelling as a team, and I think the fight was a little bit more than what we were led to believe.
But since those early June blow-ups, the Cubs have been winning most of their games. Barrett was traded shortly after his fight with Zambrano, and according to Kenster, players are responding to Pinella differently than they did with their last manager, Dusty Baker.
Dusty Baker, he's a good manager, and I think a lot of people stress that he was a player's manager where he would understand because he played, but so did Lou Pinella, but Lou Pinella is a little bit more high-strung, and I think he's won everything. He's won a World Series. He's played with great World Series teams, and he knows how to win one-on-one with the players. He'll tell you what he expects, and if you don't give it to him, you'll be gone, and I think the players respect that, and I think that's why they're coming together, and they will play hard under Pinella.
For some, the mistakes that marked their last shining season in 2003 remain clear in the minds of fans like Tim O'Donohue, who saw the game in Chicago. He now lives in Ireland, but returned this day to Wrigley Field.
It's wicked. The time they came back from Florida that time with the two-game lead, and we had Pryor and Woods coming up, and we blew it. Oh, that was terrible. After that, I said I'd never go to another Cubs game.
But for Matt Scalaris, the season is far from over, and the Cubs have to get through some tough teams before the postseason comes into play.
Houston's solid. The Cardinals are always, you know, up at the top of the division. It's not as easy as everyone makes it out. We got to play against some tough ball clubs. I mean, the Astros will come around. They got the pitching to do it. The Cardinals have the bats to do it. So it's not an easy division by any means, I don't think.
Your prediction for the end of this year?
World Series. Zambrano's getting a Cy Young, and we're winning the World Series.
For Only a Game, I'm Yolanda Perdomo in Chicago.
Please respect the honor and tradition of Wrigley Field by exhibiting appropriate fan behavior.
Coming up on Only a Game, the games people play when anchored down in Anchorage. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
NBA Commissioner David Stern said in his Tuesday press conference that the investigation of former league referee Tim Donaghy was the worst situation he has ever experienced. Common sports wisdom has it that the great players rise to the occasion. Can Stern rise to this one?
He can rise to it as long as there's not another shoe out there ready to drop. If there's more to this than just Tim Donaghy, then I think Mr. Stern's job is in peril. Right now, everybody who supervises officials in the NBA has to go because they simply didn't do their jobs. Donaghy was a problem far beyond just the betting, although that's the worst part. I mean, they have people, you know, claiming that he set fire to their tractor, for God's sakes. It's interesting, though, because for all the hot air spent in the last 5 or 6 years by people saying that the problem with the NBA was the thug life, gangster rap culture, it turns out like it was a white referee dealing with the old line mob that might do the worst damage to the NBA that's been done in 50 years.
On Thursday, Michael Vick and three co-defendants pleaded not guilty in Richmond to federal dogfighting charges. Regardless of what Vick has been charged with and may yet be charged with, he hasn't been convicted of anything, but Michael Vick may not join the Falcons for the team's preseason camp. If you were the NFL commissioner, would you hold him out of football?
I think everybody so far in this has done the right thing. They've passed the buck in a proper fashion. I think that the NFL is probably dealing with the feds on a level we're not aware of as to this. Right now, the conditions of his probation make it practically impossible for him to play for Atlanta anyway. He has to stay in Virginia. He surrendered his passport. He can't go to training camp anyway until the trial starts, which is after Thanksgiving.
Former Atlanta Falcon Deion Sanders recently offered a defense of Vic, saying, among other things, that Vic, quote, has a passion for dogfighting. I just wonder if Vic needs that kind of support right now.
Yeah, the more interesting thing, of course, was that he said that he knows many athletes who share this passion, which has been sort of bubbling around the fringes of this story all along, that there are more than a few people who have been to places like Michael Vick's Festival of Brutality and enjoyed it. Deion, on the other hand, as you said, is really, with friends like this, who needs Leavenworth, basically. What a dog means to Vic might be a lot different than what he means to you or I. Well, yes, that's true, Deion. I imagine it. He probably does.
Wake Forest basketball coach Skip Prosser died Thursday after collapsing while he was jogging. Would you care to remember for us the late Mr. Prosser?
He was a terrific coach and a terrific guy, and there aren't many of them of which both things can be said in college basketball. This is a real, real loss.
Tomorrow, Charlie, in Jakarta, Iraq's national soccer team will play Saudi Arabia in the Asian Cup final. My feeling is that the success of the team and the joy that this team has brought to Iraqis constitutes a triumph. But the horrific loss of life in Baghdad on Wednesday after car bombs took the lives of more than 50 of the people celebrating the semifinal match make it awfully difficult to celebrate a winning soccer team.
Yeah, when people talk to me about National Football League teams playing under pressure at any point during the season, I'm going to point them to this story and point out that life could be a lot worse than having to fly to Tampa to play a game. The Iraq team progressing through to the Asian Cup Finals is a terrific story. What happened when the people went outside to celebrate on Wednesday is unfortunately sadly emblematic of the entire adventure over there.
In case people haven't been listening over the course of the last few minutes, Charlie, it has been an extraordinarily grim week in sports.
Bad week.
Can you recall another week that's given us this much mayhem, ugliness, intrigue, criminality? The list goes on and on.
I'm sure there are other weeks where a lot of this stuff went on, but it isn't quite as garish. When you're talking about federal dogfighting conspiracies and crooked referees and car bombs in the middle of celebrations. No, this is a weakus horribilis like none I remember.
Let's try to move on to some happier stories. In baseball news, Craig Biggio has announced that he will retire at the end of this season, and I wonder how many National League pitchers are looking forward to one last chance to hit him.
Well, he's got 3,000 hits. He's going to the Hall of Fame. The night he announced his retirement, he hit a grand slam. So that's the way to go out. That's the way to begin going out, I guess.
Yeah, but he's only a couple of hit-by-pitches away from holding the all-time record for that.
Well, all he has to do is hit a few more grand slams, and I guarantee you, next at-bat, he's going down. Step into one, Craig. Huey Jennings has been in the record book for too long. Get him out of there.
What do you think of the new National Football League vest rule, which would require press photographers to wear red vests sporting various corporate logos as they go about their work?
Well, I think it's the NFL trying to demonstrate that everything you do in the world is only with their permission. I applaud David Shribman, who used to be at my newspaper, the Boston Globe, is now at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, in refusing to do that. This is a giant leap over the line, wherever the line is, and the NFL should back down, or they should be made to back down by their corporate media partners. Charlie, I'm not standing on one leg waiting for that, by the way.
Charlie, we spoke a while back about Oscar Pistorius, the runner who competes on prosthetic legs. The International Association of Athletics Federations will try to figure out whether those prosthetic legs give Mr. Pistorius an unfair advantage over runners with legs that are not prosthetic. How do you suppose the IAAF will make a distinction between a fair advantage and an unfair one?
I don't know, but I give Mr. Pistorius a lot of credit because he's going to go work with the scientists and try to find out. He seems to be in this issue for the long haul. He's going to try to make things work for people in his position, and I applaud him for that. And while I have very little use for the IAAF in a lot of areas, I think they're going about this the right way. They're actually going to study the science of it and see if it's right or not.
Brian Jackson of Brentwood, Pennsylvania.
Who is he really?
That's a good question, and we'll get to that. Anyway, Mr. Jackson of Brentwood, Pennsylvania, was sentenced on Wednesday to 90 days of jail and 5 years probation after he was found guilty of theft by deception and identity theft. But what does that have to do with sports?
Well, because he was having at one point impersonated both Pittsburgh Steeler quarterbacks. In his life, he was impersonating the Steelers tight end Jeremy Tooman, and he got a woman to loan him $3,200. My question is, you wouldn't loan $3,200 to a stranger, but you'd loan it to a stranger who said he was one of the Steelers.
And finally, Charlie, only a game listener, Andy DePalma, called to our attention the story of a Romanian soccer team that has employed a unique training strategy. Would you care to speak about that for us?
Yes, people always, when something bad happens at NFL training camps, people always say, what do you expect? These guys aren't living in a monastery. Guess what? The Romanian soccer team is spending 10 days at, wait for it, a monastery.
There you go.
They're going to eat only the food. They're going to live in total silence, interrupted only by religious music. I think the whole notion of soccer players sort of wandering around with their mouths shut, not complaining about anything, is a great idea.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Ben, Jeremy, Brian, who are you? Oh, Bill. Bill, thank you, Bill.
The World Eskimo Indian Olympics have been held in Fairbanks, Alaska since their inception in 1961. This year, organizers brought the four-day extravaganza of native games, dance, art, and culture to Anchorage, the state's most populous city. And last week, 500 participants and 1,000-plus spectators flocked to Sullivan Arena each day to view the competition. Rebecca Shear of the Alaska Public Radio Network was there, and she has our report.
In some ways, the World Eskimo Indian Olympics, or WEIO, are just like any other big Olympic-type event. There's an arena full of hard-working athletes. The awarding of medals.
And the second-place winner, let's hear it for Noelle Strick.
And throngs of fans, not the least bit shy about demonstrating their enthusiasm. But there's also dancing and drumming. A seal-skinning contest. Even a native baby pageant, with prizes for best cloth, fur, and hide regalia. Just one of the 25 or so events.
Most of these games had a direct link to our survival skills.
Robert Aiken Jr. of Barrow, Alaska, is one of WEIO's biggest stars, literally. The 54-year-old Inupiat isn't competing this year, but at 6'4", 350 pounds, there's a reason they still call him Big Bob.
What I do best, the strength events, was for hunters. Sometimes you needed brute force to pull up seals out of the breeding holes, or pull up walruses on top of the ice, or pull whales up on top of the ice to butcher them.
And WEIO's strength events are designed to simulate these hunting skills, like the Eskimo stick pole, where opponents sit face-to-face and foot-to-foot. Between them is a pole. One has the inside grip, the other the outside.
A little towards James, right there.
Then, at the signal of the judge,
ready, set, pull.
They do just that. No twisting, no jerking. If you're strong enough to pull the pole out of your opponent's hands...
There you go.
Good job, guys. Good pull.
You win.
Woo!
Big Bob holds the world record for the Eskimo stick pole with 6 gold medals. He's won 7 in the Indian stick pole, which is similar, only the pole is greased to recreate the experience of catching a fish with bare hands. Aiken says many WEIO events are modeled on ancient contests that were kind of like auditions.
By these games, our elders knew who would be a good hunter. It would be an insurance policy for them to know who would be a good provider.
A strong performance could land you a role on the next whaling crew or hunting party, provided you had another crucial trait.
It's endurance of pain. Like, if our hunters went out and got hurt, a lot of these games were to show that they could endure pain.
That's Noelle Strick, a 34-year-old resident of McGrath, Alaska.
If they did go out and get hurt as hunters traditionally and didn't come back with any food because they were hurt, that wouldn't be a very strong tolerance of pain, would it?
And Noelle knows all about that. She just made it through the preliminary rounds of the ear pole. In this event, participants sit face-to-face, each with a single sinew looped around one ear. At the judge's signal, they pull their head straight back, the sinew tightening and tightening until one just can't stand it anymore. Today, Noelle faces her toughest challenge.
Our final two on the women's side is Asta Keller and Noelle Strick. This is for the championship.
Asta Keller is the 10-time defending ear pole champ. But Noelle isn't worried. After all, she's been working out.
I lifted up some 6-pound weights at home just to make sure that I was ready.
6 pounds doesn't sound like a lot until you realize that Noelle was lifting them with her ears.
1, 2, 4.
Noelle and Asta grit their teeth as the sinew, which Noelle describes as dental floss, only quadruple strength, contorts their ears into what can best be described as purple cauliflower, until Asta flicks her head to the side. She loses the sinew, and Noelle wins the championship.
I survived, and my whole life has been like that, and I'm not going to give up. One of the reasons I like this game, it's, you know, you just don't give up. You try your best.
And she was true to her word. After a day of pressing baggies of ice against her swollen scarlet ears, Noelle Strick earned another gold medal in the ear weight event. She walked 231 feet with a 16-pound lead weight dangling from her ear.
Let's play this game.
Hey. 40-year-old Brian Randazzo holds world records in the one-foot high kick and his favorite, the two-foot high kick.
This game, I think, is probably one of the hardest games. It works all your muscles. There's a burr ball suspended in the air, and you have to jump off of 2 feet, kick the target with both of your toes, and you have to land simultaneously with both feet without losing your balance or falling.
Which, as with so many of the games at WIO, is easier said than done. Especially when that fur ball is 8 feet 8 inches off the ground, like in 1988 when the beefy Anchorage resident set the world record.
There you go.
This year, Brian is judging the final round of the 2-foot high kick, which was once used as a hunting signal. When a whaling crew or a hunting party caught something on the ice or tundra, they'd send a messenger to alert the villagers. He did so by kicking his feet high into the air. At the WIO event, kickers get 3 chances. If they succeed, the ball is raised a few inches. And David Thomas, an 18-year-old from Palmer, Alaska, who's been competing in WIO since he was 12, is down to his last try. But before David makes his jump, Brian pulls him aside.
I'm all the way up. You're halfway here. You've got to open him up. You're still a little bit bent.
It isn't every day you see judges helping athletes in the middle of a sporting event. And even though in the end David misses the ball, Brian Randazzo says that doesn't matter, because at WIO, winning and losing aren't nearly as important as heritage.
Well, these games, before they were called games, it was a way of sharing your knowledge and your history and your culture. As Native people, we had to do that to ensure that our cultures would survive. Everything that was taught to you was a gift to you, and it's not your right to keep it. So it's my duty, it's my responsibility, getting older now, is to pass on the knowledge and the skills and all the respect and everything that I learned from my elders to the younger people.
For Only a Game, I'm Rebecca Shear in Anchorage.
Writing about the Tour de France is risky. Between the beginning and the end of a 2-minute commentary, a rider may be pulled from the competition for cheating. What I just said may have become obsolete. It could have been 2 riders just then, maybe 3. When Michael Rasmussen, the leader of the race as of Wednesday, was tossed out of it on Thursday, Christiane Prudhomme, the race organizer, said it was, quote, probably the best thing that has happened in the last 8 days. You might be forgiven for figuring that Mr. Prudhomme had gone mad. During the previous day, Alexander Vinokourov was tossed from the race, after which his whole team left the course. But that was nothing. On the same day Rasmussen was bagged, Christiane Marini, whose team had advocated cleaning up the sport, was yanked off the tour after a positive testosterone test. So maybe watching the steady flow of departing riders had sent Mr. Prudhomme over the edge. The guy's in charge of the most important race in a sport that currently provokes ridicule and raspberries. No wonder he's sounding like Chief Inspector Dreyfus after one too many encounters with Inspector Clouseau. In any case, Mr. Prudhomme maintained that Michael Rasmussen's ouster proved that, quote, things are changing for the better. Unhappily, the other possibility is that things are not changing at all. Positive drug tests and the disputing of same means we still don't know who won the tour last year. Winners of other tours have acknowledged that they doped, though some of them have waited years to do so. This year's winner will likely prevail essentially by attrition. At Only a Game, we had decided before this year's tour began that we would pretend it wasn't happening. Karen Given found a wonderful story about a bunch of bicycle riders in New Hampshire who'd never experimented with any performance-enhancing substance more potent than herb tea. That was to be it for 2-wheeled diversions. We would swear off the Tour de France. That was pretty much an invitation for the tour to turn and bite us in the backside, wasn't it? And it did. This year's tour has set a modern record for embarrassment. No mean achievement, given the tour's recent calamities. There's no way a sports program can fail to acknowledge such a superbly stupid development. Consider it done. Thanks for listening to Only a Game. Please check your local listings for the NPR station nearest you to carry our show, and please visit our website, onlyagame.org.